ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जयमुदीरयेत्। नष्टप्रायेष्वभद्रेषु नित्यं भागवतसेवया भगवत्युत्तमश्लोके भक्तिर्भवति नैष्ठिकी। रीडिंग फ्रॉम द श्रीमद् भागवतम कैंटो 2 चैप्टर 9 टाइटल्ड आंसर्स बाय साइटिंग द लॉर्ड्स वर्जन टेक्स्ट 25। ब्रह्मा उवाच भगवन् सर्व ब्रह्मोवाच भगवन् सर्वभूतानां अध्यक्षोऽवस्थितो गुहाम् वेदह्यप्रतिरुद्धेन प्रज्ञानेन चिकीर्षितम् ब्रह्मा उवाच। बट व्हेन इट्स प्रोनाउंस्ड टुगेदर इट इज ब्रह्मोवाच। So the two words when it's split up are Brahma and Uvacha. Uvacha means said. Brahma is of course Lord Brahma. But when the two words are combined, it becomes Brahma Uvacha, as it's written over here. Brahma Uvacha.
Brahma Uvacha.
Lord Brahma said.
Lord Brahma said.
Bhagavan.
Bhagavan.
Oh my Lord.
Oh my Lord.
So it is not Bhagavan here, it is Bhagavan. Yes, and not the long thing. So sometimes when in the form of address, it says Bhagavan. Bhagavan, O my Lord. Sarva Bhutanam. Of all living entities. Adhyakshaha. Director. Avasthitaha. Situated. Guham. Within the heart. Veda.
No.
He. Certainly. Apratiruddhena. Without hindrance. Prajnanena. By super intelligence. Chikirshitam. Endeavors. Purport and translation by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Translation. Lord Brahma said, O Personality of Godhead, you are situated in every living entity's heart as the Supreme Director. And therefore, you are aware of all endeavors by your superior intelligence, without any hindrance whatsoever. Purport. The Bhagavad Gita confirms that the Lord is situated in everyone's heart as the witness, and as such, He is the Supreme Director of sanction. The Director is not the enjoyer of the fruits of action. For without the Lord's sanction, no one can enjoy. For example, in a prohibited area of in a prohibited area, a habituated drunkard puts forward his application to the director of drinking, and the director, considering his case, sanctions only a certain amount of liquor for drinking. Similarly, the whole material world is full of many drunkards, in the sense that each and every one of the living entities has something in his mind to enjoy, and everyone desires the fulfillment of his desires very strongly. The Almighty Lord, being very kind to the living entity, as the Father is kind to the Son, fulfills the living entity's desire for his childish satisfaction. With such desires in mind, the living entity does not actually enjoy, but he serves the bodily whims unnecessarily without profit. The drunkard does not derive any profit out of drinking, but because he has become a servant of the drinking habit and does not wish to get out of it, the merciful Lord gives him all facilities to fulfill such desires. The impersonalists recommend that one should become desireless, and others recommend banishing desires altogether. That is impossible. No one can banish desires altogether, because desiring is the living symptom. Without having desires, a living entity would be dead, which he is not. Therefore, living conditions and desire go together. Perfection of desires may be achieved when one desires to serve the Lord. And the Lord also desires that every living entity banish all personal desires and cooperate with his desires. That is the last instruction of the Bhagavad Gita. Brahmaji agreed to this proposal, and therefore he is given the responsible post of creating generations in the vacant universe. Oneness with the Lord therefore consists of dovetailing one's desires with the desires of the Supreme Lord. That makes for the perfection of all desires. The Lord, as the super soul in the heart of every living being, knows what is in the mind of each living entity, and no one can do anything without the knowledge of the Lord within. By his superior intelligence, the Lord gives everyone the intelligence to fulfill his desires to the fullest extent. And the resultant reaction is also awarded by the Lord. Om Ajnanatimirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kada Mahyam Dadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yudapadakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sakrajatam Sahakandaragunathan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahakandalalita Shri Vishakhan Vitamscha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Preshthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine Vancha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna. The Lord has appeared before Brahmaji, has shaken his hands, has blessed him, empowered him, to perform the very difficult task of creation of the universe. And now Brahmaji offers him prayers. In the very first prayer, he declares the all-pervasive nature of the Lord as a super soul living in everyone's heart. And because he is present in everyone's heart, therefore by his superior or super intelligence, he knows everything that's going on in our minds, in our hearts. He knows everything that we do. And there is no hindrance in this perfect knowledge of the Lord. As far as we are concerned, we human beings or we living entities, individual living entities, our intelligence is limited because we are not present everywhere. And even where we are present, there are hindrances to our understanding of the world around us. We are hindered by time, in the sense that we don't remember what happened in the past. We don't know what will be happening at present, in the future. And even at present, we are hampered by space. We don't know what's happening in the next room, what to speak of what is happening in another town or another country, another continent. We are also hampered by circumstances. Suppose we fall asleep in the class, we don't know what the speaker is saying. So even though we are not separated by space or time, but by circumstances, because we have fallen asleep, so then we don't know what has been spoken in the class. So time, place, circumstance, these things cause a hindrance to us. Sometimes there are physical obstructions, sometimes there are various kinds of hindrances or obstructions that come in the way of our understanding certain things or obtaining knowledge. So we cannot even actually understand clearly or properly what is going on within our own bodies. Let's take the act of eating, for example. We place some food into our mouth and we can understand something about it by taste. And we like it, we taste it, we chew it, and then swallow it. But once we swallow it, then we don't know what happens to it. Then it goes inside, we don't understand how it's getting digested. Even in the mouth, what's going on? In the throat, how it's getting pushed down through the throat and going down into the stomach, the intestines, how the process of digestion is taking place, how the food, the nutrients in the food get assimilated into the body, and then how they are transmitted throughout the body so that the body gets nourished. How is that food metabolized? How is that food metabolized so that ultimately it gets nourished? The body gets nourishment, and then we get strength and intelligence to perform our actions. We don't understand that. So there is direct knowledge, but even direct knowledge of ourselves we don't have. We just know that it happens. We presume it, we take it for granted that these things are happening in our body by the workings of nature. The only time we get worried about it when things don't happen the way they should, then we have to go to a doctor. So, in the Srimad Bhagavatam also, it is said, Janmadyasyatonvayad itaratas charthesh abhigyaha swarat. Krishna is abhigyaha in the sense that he knows everything. But he knows everything directly as well as indirectly. Whereas we as living entities know very little directly, and even further less we know indirectly. Directly meaning that we are actually seeing it or feeling it or tasting it. That's called direct directly knowing something. And indirectly knowing something is through so many inferences and so on. So Krishna knows everything perfectly, directly as well as indirectly. So we do not know even ourselves, our own bodies, directly and indirectly. In the Bhagavad Gita also, Krishna has explained that he actually knows everything past, present and future. Vedaham samatitani vartamanani charjuna bhavishyani cha bhutani mam tu vedana kashchana. So, Veda aham, he says, I know everything. Veda aham samatitani. Samatitani means that which has already elapsed. Then vartamanani, that which is going on at present. Bhavishyani, that which is going to happen in the future for all living entities. I know every living entity, and I know everything past, present and future in relation to every living entity. And that's super intelligence, isn't it? So this is an important statement Krishna makes in the Bhagavad Gita. I know the past, present and future of every living entity. But mam tu vedana kashchana, but no one knows me. Because Krishna is unlimited. Of course, Krishna knows himself. But apart from Krishna, no one knows himself. And why is it that Krishna knows every living entity's past, present and future? Apratiruddhena. Because there is no hindrance to his knowledge. Time is not a hindrance to his knowledge. Time is a hindrance to our knowledge. Because of time, there is past, present and future. So many times people ask this question, why don't we remember our previous lives? You say that there is something like a past life. So why is it that we don't remember? If we don't remember there was a past life, why should we believe in it? So for us, there are many hindrances to knowledge. Time is one of them. And it's not just that we don't remember what happened in a previous life. We don't even remember many things that happened in this life. When we were in our mother's womb, we don't remember. When we were little children, we don't remember. We don't remember events that happened even a few minutes ago many times. So time is a hindrance. And also there are certain painful experiences which we undergo, like death and birth and so on, which again create forgetfulness. They cause hindrances or obstructions to our memory. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna also says, Bahuni me vyatitani janmani tava charjuna. He says that I remember everything. You and I both have had many, many lives. But I remember all of them and you don't remember them. So Krishna remembers all the past appearances he has made. But we do not remember, thankfully. So because we have hindrances, Krishna's understanding and knowledge is free of hindrances. Because he is superior to everything that could possibly cause a hindrance. But we are under the control of all those things that cause hindrance. Only something that is superior to you can cause a hindrance. But nothing is superior to Krishna. So what can cause an obstruction for him? So we are therefore obstructed by the material nature. And we are obstructed by time, the time factor. But Krishna is the controller of the time factor. Time is his energy. He is also the controller of the material energy. So therefore these two can never be hindrances for him. And because time and space are not hindrances, Krishna is present everywhere. And because he is present everywhere, he knows everything. Nowadays, we are human beings try to be present everywhere by other technological means, like placing CCTV cameras everywhere. so that we try to be present everywhere indirectly. So we get information, what's happening in this part of the premises, what's happening in that room. Or we have bugs, spies, you know, espionage agencies are always bugging the enemy's rooms and areas so they can hear what's going on. Or they place these secret cameras and do sting operations so they can secretly film things. So we try to be present everywhere artificially through technology. Or we try to be present everywhere indirectly through other people. We have our spies who are everywhere, informants who are everywhere giving us information, what's happening here, what's happening there. So we try to obtain information through various sources. And thus we try to be omnipresent, but that's not possible. But Krishna is directly present everywhere. Andantarastha paramanu chayantarastham golok eva nivasatya khilatma bhuto. So Krishna, Brahmaji says in his Brahma Samhita, is present in Goloka Vrindavan, in his original kingdom. But at the same time, he is also present in every atom, not just in the heart of every living entity, but also in every atom. So since Lord Krishna is present everywhere, he can see everything, he can hear everything, he can feel everything, so he knows everything. Suppose we were able to expand ourselves to be present in every room in the temple premises, then we would know everything that was going on in every room. Of course, that's not possible for us, that's another question. But even though we are present in every room, still we wouldn't know everything. For example, I don't know what you're thinking about right now. What's going on in your mind? That I cannot know. The only time I can know what's going on in your mind is when your eyelids are closed. That's when I can understand, yes, you're probably dreaming of prasadam or something. But Krishna is actually present everywhere. And Krishna is the super conscious being. Therefore, he has super senses, he has spiritual senses. And with those senses, he perceives things just as we do. In fact, unless Krishna perceives, we cannot perceive anything. We cannot see, hear, touch, taste and smell, unless Krishna does so. So Krishna is the original experiencer of everything. So because Krishna is all-pervasive in the form of the Super Soul, who is present even in every atom, therefore he knows everything. So people generally do not understand what God is or who God is. Therefore we find that if somebody exhibits a bit of mystic power, some innocent and gullible people immediately declare that person to be God. And that so-called God also becomes so illusioned by this little display of power that he doesn't deny that he is God. When confronted, he will say that, "I never said I am God." But then if he doesn't think he's God, why doesn't he deny it when his followers declare him to be God? Maunam sammati lakshanam. Sometimes silence is evidence of acquiescence, that means of agreement. So if somebody says, you know, you are God and I keep mum, that means I agree with what he's saying. I need not say, yes, yes, I am God. The fact that I keep quiet when somebody proclaims me to be God is indication that I agree with him. So because of the exhibition of a little mystic power, then we think somebody becomes God. So we have no idea what it means to be God. So is it possible humanly for anyone to know anything, everything that is going on everywhere at all times? This is Krishna's position. In the Bhagavad Gita also, Krishna says the same thing several places. Ishvara sarva bhutanam riddeshi arjuna tishtati brahman sarva bhutanam yantrarudhani mahayaya. He says, I am the Supreme Lord is seated in the heart of every living entity and is directing his wanderings. Similarly, he also says in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita that he is present in every heart. And from him come knowledge, forgetfulness and remembrance. So the Lord in the heart is always prompting us with knowledge and remembrance, and sometimes even forgetfulness. You know, sometimes we lament the nature of us being forgetful. But in the material world, that's a very important quality to have. We think only remembrance is something wonderful. But even forgetfulness is something so important for our life. What to speak of forgetfulness of things in the previous life, we also need many times to forget things in the present life. Because if, for example, we've had a run-in with somebody, and then that person said something to us, imagine if we remembered that for all our life. Many times we tend to do it. But it's good, we should forget. We should forget that such and such person said this to us. Otherwise we hold it in our life and it causes us so much misery. So by Krishna's grace, sometimes we may be helped to forget. So that gives us some peace of mind. Sleep is also a kind of forgetfulness. Because you forget your present situation. You forget who you are. So imagine if we could not get sleep, what would happen? Insomniacs, they understand how difficult it is. When I was in another country, one lady came to me with her daughter. And the daughter was a university student. And the mother had a problem, and she really wanted help. And she said, I have a very peculiar situation with my daughter. She doesn't sleep. So I presume that she meant she doesn't sleep enough. You know, like parents always think about the children, they don't eat enough, they don't sleep enough, or whatever. So I presume that she meant that. She said, no, she doesn't sleep at all. I said, at all, meaning no, N-O sleep? She said, yes. So I said, for how long? She said, for 2 years, she has not slept. So I said, I don't believe this. I said, I don't believe that such a thing is humanly possible. So she said, no, she said, doctors are not able to understand. They're trying to put her to sleep. They may give her sedatives but something, but she's not able to sleep. And she was talking like a normal girl. She said, I feel a little tired, but I just can't sleep. And then curiously enough, in another place, I met another person who also had a similar problem, but it wasn't as severe. Can you imagine 2 years without any sleep? Of course, yes, it is said that Lakshman did not sleep for 13 years, or 14 years when they were in exile. That's why when he got back to Ayodhya, at the coronation, Lakshman was yawning. And that was not a very pleasant thing to do. You know, his brother is being crowned as a king, sitting in the crowd in the hall, and then he goes like that, you know. And then people were surprised, but Ram said, you know, he hasn't slept for 13 years, or 14 years. But of course, that was Treta Yuga. But here, that someone can't sleep for 2 years, just imagine what would be our condition. If we don't get good sleep for one night, then we feel down the next day. So sleep is also kind of forgetfulness, and by Krishna's mercy, we get that forgetfulness. That's very important. Similarly, death is also a kind of forgetfulness that also comes by Krishna's mercy, and that's also good. Imagine if somebody continued on living 200 years of age in this kind of body. By the time you become 60 or 70, the body gives so much trouble. Imagine a body that's 100 years old. You know, you're bent all over, the body is giving so much trouble. And imagine if the same body continued living for another 100 years. So much misery. So in that case, death is a kind of a relief. It's a kind of a forgetfulness. It's also like an extended sleep. So momentary forgetfulness, sleep, death, they're all different phases of forgetfulness. And all this comes by Krishna's mercy because He's sitting in the heart and He can give us this forgetfulness. Then sometimes He gives us the memory, He gives us the knowledge as well. He gives us forgetfulness, but next morning when we wake up, if He doesn't give us remembrance, then we are lost. Imagine you wake up and you don't know who you are. Or imagine you don't wake up. He doesn't stop that forgetfulness. He doesn't give you that remembrance again. Which means you don't wake up. And you keep on sleeping. Or even if you wake up and He doesn't give you remembrance of your situation, so you don't know who you are, you don't know where you are sitting, you don't know who the people around you are, like it happens in some cases of accidents and such traumas. People get amnesia, they get forgetfulness. So Krishna, as it were, from within the heart, is turning the knobs, you know, turning the switches, forgetfulness, knowledge, remembrance, forgetfulness, knowledge, remembrance. Tuk, 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 tuk. He's turning according to our karma, according to our destiny, according to what He thinks we deserve. He switches the knobs from this end to that end, all this, the spectrum, entire spectrum. He switches and turns, and still we think we are in control. We desire and we deserve. And according to what we deserve, then Krishna fulfills. Srila Prabhupada mentions here that the Supreme Lord is a facilitator, the fulfiller of our desires. In the Bhagavad Gita also Krishna says, Upadrashtanu mantacha bharta bhokta maheshwaraha paramatmeti chapyukto dehesmin purusha paraha. He says there is a superior purusha or enjoyer in the body. He is the paramatma, the super soul. Dehe asmin. So inside the deha, inside the body, there is purusha paraha. There is a supreme enjoyer. And what is he called? Paramatmeti chapyukto. He is called paramatma. Param Atma, the super soul. And what does he do? Seated in the heart of every living entity? Upadrashta, Anumanta, Bharta, Bhokta. He is the overseer of everything that's going on in that living entity's life. He is a witness. He is a permitter. Anumanta means one who gives permission or sanction. He is a lord and master. He is the enjoyer, the true enjoyer. So therefore, sitting in our heart, He witnesses everything. He understands our innermost desires even better than we do. So we can't cheat Krishna. We can't hide anything from Krishna. There was a little story about one ancient Gurukul where a teacher has many children with him. They were living in the countryside. And one time he gave them a test. He said, now is the time for an examination. Let us see if you can pass this. He gave each of them a fruit and said, you go and eat this fruit in a place where no one is watching you. So they all dispersed in different directions. One of them must have been really hungry. He just went behind a bush and ate the fruit. The other one went somewhere in a cave. The third one went in the dark jungle. And someone went, you know, everyone went to different places. So they all came back and said, oh Gurudev, we have eaten the fruit in a place where nobody saw us. We hid ourselves very nicely and so we could eat the fruit. And then one little boy came back very late. much after everyone else had come back, and he still had the fruit in his hand. So the teacher asked him, "What happened? Why didn't you eat the fruit?" He said, "Gurudev, it's not that I didn't want to follow your instructions, but I just couldn't because I couldn't find any place where nobody is watching me." So the guru wanted to test him. So he said, "Well, what about this boy? He went into the cave, this one went behind the tree, this one did that, and you could have also hidden in a place where no one's watching you." So the boy replied, "But God is watching me everywhere. So how could I find a place where nobody is watching me? Even in the forest, the trees are watching, the birds are watching, the insects are watching, the moon and the sun are watching, the four directions are watching, the different gods are watching, the Supreme Lord is watching everywhere." So he said, "Yes, you are the most intelligent student among all my students." Practical application of philosophy. So Krishna is watching from everything we do, every thought we have. There's nothing that Krishna doesn't know in our life. Sometimes people ask the question, "Does Krishna or God know what we are going to do in the future?" He said, "Yes." Then if he does know, then where is the question of our free will? Have you heard this question? How would you answer this question? Let's say you are preaching to somebody, you're explaining Bhagavad Gita to somebody, and you say that, you know, you're talking of karma and you're talking of Krishna. Does he know everything, first of all? Does he know what you're going to do in the future? How many say yes? Any doubts? Doubtful? Yes. We just heard that there is no hindrance for Krishna. For Krishna's knowledge, time is not a hindrance, space is not a hindrance, circumstances are not a hindrance. That Krishna is omniscient, he knows everything at all times for all people. So if there is something that Krishna doesn't know, then he's not God. How can he be God? So if you say, it's a trick question, you see? So the person who's asking you the question is trying to trap you. Yeah? So you say, "Does Krishna know everything? And if he does, then what's the meaning of my free will?" So he's trying to get you to a point to accept that either Krishna doesn't know everything, or that you don't have free will. You get the point? So the first question, therefore, does Krishna know what we're going to do in the future? One moment in the future, 1 year in the future, a million years in the future? Yes. Otherwise he can't be God. So the next question, if he does know the future, then if he doesn't know how I'm going to act in the future, then where's the question of my free will? Who would like to answer that? Yes. So then do I still have my free will?
Yes.
How? He knows everything. He knows how I will act. Yes, actually you answered the question in the first line itself. He knows how we will use our free will. That's the correct answer. He doesn't interfere with our free will. The fact that Krishna knows how we are going to act in the future doesn't mean that he's going to interfere with our free will. He simply knows that this living entity wants to do this, wants to do that, will act in this way in the future, will act in that way in the future, will use the free will this way in the future. So Krishna knows how we are going to use our free will in the future. That's all. He simply knows and facilitates it. But he doesn't interfere unless we want him to interfere. When we become devotees, then we say, let thy will be done on earth as it will be in heaven. Yes. Or tava asmi, I am yours. So there is no contradiction here. If Krishna knows everything in the future, but he doesn't interfere with the free will, and that's what Srila Prabhupada is mentioning here in the purport, that Krishna will keep our free will intact, and if we desire something that is sinful, that is not proper, and if we deserve it, Krishna may still sanction it. It doesn't mean that Krishna wants it. Srila Prabhupada gives the analogy here of the drunkard, and he's talking about the director of drinking. Now probably these terms may be a little strange to you, but we have to see it in the historical context when Prabhupada wrote the purports. You see, in India, in those days, which is where Prabhupada was when he wrote these purports of the first two cantos, there was a time when the government would introduce what is called prohibition. Prohibition means that alcohol would not be sold, and it was a crime to consume alcohol and even to sell it. However, the government noticed that there are some people who are so habituated to drinking that if you don't allow them drinking facility legally, then they will do it illegally. So there would be illicit brewing of liquor going on in different ways, surreptitiously. So then in order to stop that, the government said, okay, so we'll have select drinking outlets where we'll sell you alcohol, but you've got to have a permit. So you've got to go to some authority and get a permit that, you know, I can buy so much alcohol in a month or a week or whatever. And then they allow you that. So there's somebody who's in charge of deciding. So he's giving, sorry?
He's the director
of drinking, you know, so that's what it means. So this was the situation. Otherwise we may be perplexed. What is the meaning of director of drinking? Never heard of such a... That doesn't mean that he's an expert drinker. That doesn't mean that. It just means that he's overseeing the affairs of all the drunkards, trying to see that things are kept in check somewhat, you see. So now Prabhupada argues like this. He says, the government actually doesn't want people to drink. Nowadays it's a different issue. They want people to drink. In fact, because they get a lot of revenue. In India, this is a fact, because they get so much of taxes from the liquor industry that they're encouraging the liquor industry. A far cry from the Vedic culture. So, in the early days, in the times of when Prabhupada was writing the purports, the government didn't want the public to drink. But they allowed the public to drink in a very careful way, in a regulated way, because that is what some individuals wanted, and they were going to do it anyway. So might as well just fulfill it and see that things are in control. So similarly, when the living entity develops sinful desires, Krishna permits it. It doesn't mean that Krishna wants that living entity to commit sinful activities. It's just that he sanctions it. There's a difference between sanctioning something and permitting and wanting something. Or let's take the example. One time I had a devotee who had a teenage son. And the teenage son was very keen to get a motorcycle. And not just a motorcycle, but a kind of motorcycle that was one of those racing kind of motorcycles. And the father was really worried, you know, because this boy is a little hot-headed and he's going to go on the motorcycle, zoom, and get into accidents. So he was a little concerned. So he had run-ins with his son every day in the house because son said, get me a motorcycle, buy me a motorcycle. The father was really not keen, but when everything got to an extent, he said, okay, finally he relented. He said, all right, I'll buy you a motorcycle. So he bought the son a motorcycle. So this example, I was telling the father of this, you know, similar this example of the drinking. That's exactly what Krishna does with us. You know, we are stubborn, we are obstinate. No, I want to enjoy independently, I want to enjoy. Krishna says, look, it's not the place for you to be. You should be with me in Krishna Loka. You serve me nicely and we live together happily, having wonderful transcendental pastimes. But we said, no, I want to. So, all right, okay, what can I do? Because Krishna maintains our free will. He doesn't want to interfere with our free will. Okay, if that's what you want, so be it. So then he sends us to this place, this fantasy world, Disneyland. This material world is like that Disneyland. Fantasy world, where you live in a world of fantasy. He says, okay, if that's what you want, you can have it. But remember, you won't be happy. No, I want it. All right, go. Go there. You can do it. So Krishna permits it. Krishna sanctions it. Because he cherishes the free will of the living entity. But that doesn't mean that he wants us to commit sinful activities. Because many times people ask this question, not a blade of grass moves without the will of the Lord. Therefore, if I'm committing a sin, that means the Lord wants me to commit a sin. Have you heard this logic before?
Yeah.
And this is the answer. It's not that the Lord wants you to do it. The Lord sanctions it. Let's take another example. I give this example often. If a 5-year-old child comes to the parent and says, I want to be a doctor. The parent says, very good, that's nice. So you have to study in school, we have to finish many years of school, at least 12 years of school. Then you have to enter into medical school, then study another 5 or 6 years, then you can become a doctor. The child says, no, I want to be a doctor right now. So the parent tries to explain, but that's not possible because you have another 16 or 17 or 20 years of studies to do. No, I want to be a doctor right now. So what does the parent do? So, all right, goes to the market, buys a little, toy medical kit, plastic stethoscope and then, all kinds of things, with some knives for surgery and everything. Says, okay, now you're a doctor. So the child sits there, has got his operating theater, has got his, got little medicine kits and dispenses medicines to everybody. Yes, you are sick here. Yeah, I'm going to do surgery on you, cutting up your stomach and everything. The child is in bliss for some time, or he thinks he's in bliss. Thinks he's a doctor and goes around with a stethoscope around his neck, saying, I'm a doctor. But very soon, the fun wears off. Then he starts realizing it's not the real thing. Actually, this is just, when he grows up, his intelligence matures a little bit, then he understands, actually, this is not fun anymore. Now I should go for the real thing. I should become a good student, get good grades, and then get into medical school, and I'll become a real doctor like that. This was just a dream world. So in exactly the same way, when we want to do something that's impossible, in other words, try to enjoy independently of the Lord, then Krishna says, okay, I've got the place for you. Here's the material world, here's your toy stethoscope, and enact all the fantasies you want here. And we come here and enact these fantasies. I am the Lord of all I survey. I am the enjoyer, I am the proprietor, I am the controller. I am this and I am that, and under the spell of illusion, we attempt to enjoy life in this material world. And time again, we are frustrated in our attempts to do so. We are hammered by the laws of material nature. Birth, death, old age, disease. But our motto in this world is, we shall overcome. We shall overcome one day. So we relentlessly pursue it. Okay, I didn't get it today, but tomorrow I will get it. Next life, surely I'll get it. If not now, later I will. One day I will achieve success and happiness in life. That's called Maya. The obstinacy of thinking that I can be happy independent of Krishna. So this obstinacy doesn't take us very far. But when we grow up, like the child grows up and realizes, oh, I can't be happy, this is not the real thing. So when we grow up, then we say, oh yes, that means spiritually grow up. Our spiritual intelligence awakens. Oh yes, I can't be happy here in this material world. This is a fantasy. It's not possible. So now let me surrender to Krishna and become Krishna's pure devotee. So then I can eternally live with Krishna in the spiritual world and serve Him and attain real happiness. So this is the reality of life. So this material world is a place where we all want to live in a world of illusion. You know, there's that little story that I heard one time many years ago. Of course, here you don't have washermen, you know, you have laundries, shops, you just give it to the laundry. But in the villages in India, in the old days, I guess that's changing now also, you had these people who were professional washermen. So they would collect the clothes from your house, pick it up every morning, and then they would wash it, wash the clothes. And how would they do that? They would pack the clothes, the laundry, onto the back of a donkey. They would have one or two donkeys with them who were beasts of burden, and they would carry the heavy burden of the clothes all the way to the riverside. And on the banks of the river, you know, they would use the water and then they would wash all the clothes over there, you know, leave them out to dry, and then again take them back in the evening, load them back onto the donkey and take the luggage back. So what they would sometimes do is that they would tie a stick to the neck of the donkey, and at the other end of the stick they would hang a carrot, a delicious carrot with some nice other greens and so on, lettuce, and have a nice wonderful salad at the end of the stick, like a Sunday feast for a donkey. And the donkey would think, oh, what a nice carrot that is, I want to eat it. So he would step forward. But every moment he took one step forward, the carrot also moved one step forward. But the donkey, being a donkey, doesn't understand why it's moving one step forward. But he still thinks that I can get that carrot. So he moves another step forward. The carrot goes, I say, no, next time I'll get it. He goes another step forward and all the way to the river. So in this way, the washerman induces the donkey to go all the way there and similarly on the way back. And then he gets a little carrot or a little grass. So our search for happiness in this world is like that. It's a fantasy. It's not possible. We cannot be happy in the bodily concept of life. We cannot be happy devoid of Krishna consciousness. But because that carrot is dangling before us, Maya dangles that carrot. You just do this, you just, you know, get these gadgets and you'll be happy. You just get that iPhone, that iPad, you'll be happy. You get this, you know, liquor, or get this cigarette, or get this kind of food. Or you get this house by the sea, or you do this, you'll be happy. And then we do that, we go there, but happiness keeps going ahead, further and further away. It remains as elusive as ever. It's never going to happen. And since we are on the subject of donkeys, I thought I remembered another story. Might as well complete the quota of donkey stories. One time there was one donkey and he was grazing around, and he suddenly happened to meet an old, you know, school friend of his. you know, from the time they were young friends. And so they bumped into each other. So they naturally exchanged pleasantries when talking of the good old days when they were in school together. And then they exchanged notes. So what are you doing these days? So the first one said, I'm a freelancer, you know. I just graze wherever there's grass available everywhere. I just eat that and I survive. So he asked him, what are you doing? He said, I've got a good job. Really, what kind of job do you have? He said, I work with a washerman. I said, really? So that's hard work. You have to carry, like, you know, the clothes all the way to the river and back, and you've got to do it many times a day. He said, yes. He said, why do you do it? I'm here, I can just graze everywhere, and there's grass available free, and I can eat this grass and be healthy and happy. So the second donkey, who is employed with the washerman, he said, you know, I'll tell you the secret. You see, the other day, what happened is that my master, that is the boss, his daughter committed some big mistake. So the father started shouting at the daughter. And he said, you are such a fool. If you do this mistake again, I'll marry you to my donkey. So he said, I'm waiting for that day. You know. Of course, however angry the father may have been with the daughter, you know, this is one thing he would never do for sure. But still, the donkey had that hope. One day, I will be able to marry this girl. So, you know, our hopes for happiness are like that. One day, I shall overcome. Never give up, never give up. So therefore, we go on life after life, millions and trillions of lives. We don't know how many lives we have spent here in this vain search for happiness. And Krishna descends very kindly into this world in so many different ways. Through the scripture, in the form of his holy name, through the association of devotees and saintly persons, in the form of the deity. And see, Krishna is waiting, patiently standing. All he does, he's just standing there waiting, playing his flute. Come. He's inviting us, come back to me. We're saying, hold on. Wait, I have some other things to do. I'll finish off this and I'll finish off that and then I'll come to you. There was a great devotee in India. His name was Tukaram. Prabhupada spoke about him sometimes. And in the western state of Maharashtra, Tukaram is very popular. He was an out-and-out devotee, pure devotee, undoubtedly. He wrote many, many beautiful songs about Krishna. And so eventually, as the saying goes, there's folklore about him. It says the time came for him to leave this world, and he could actually see the Vishnu Dutas coming in a vehicle. And the Vishnu Dutas came and invited, yes, come back, we are taking you back to Vaikuntha. You know. And so he was about to go, then he thought he'd ask his wife. You see, he had he used to always have family problems because his wife was not a devotee. And she did not like her husband to be so involved in Krishna consciousness, because he used to be so involved that he would neglect working for a livelihood. Somehow Krishna would provide, but it was a hard life. So his wife was very, very bitter about this whole thing. So she didn't like it at all, and she would constantly torment him and taunt him and, you know, have quarrels with him. So it was not a good domestic life at all. And she was always saying, you know, even our children, see, they are hungry, and, you know, he would say, Krishna will provide, you know. So when the time came for him to go to Vaikuntha, The children had grown up a little bit. And he saw the Vimana, the aeroplane, coming in from there. Then he went to his wife, you know, come, why don't you come with me? Because he told the Vishnu Dutas, look, let me take my wife along with me when I come to Vaikuntha. So they said, all right, we'll wait. Of course, they knew what the answer would be. So then he went to his wife. He says, come, we can go to Vaikuntha. The plane is here. The flight is about to depart. It's a chartered flight, especially for me, for you. So she said, no, Vaikuntha. Who's going to bathe my buffaloes and who's going to milk the buffaloes? They had buffaloes at home where they would get milk. So she was more interested in milking the buffaloes and taking care of the buffaloes than here was an invitation to go back to Vaikuntha. But she wanted to be here. So that's the stuff of folklore in, you know, in connection with Tukaram. So that is our situation. Krishna's inviting us, standing here, and he has manifested himself in so many wonderful deity forms in different parts of the world. He just patiently waits. It's amazing, his patience. For millions and millions of lives, he's waiting patiently for us, with us in our heart. But we're always saying, after some time, after some time, after some time. So he's calling us now, yes, come on, surrender to me, become my pure devotee. That is the right use of our free will, to align our will with that of the Lord. Just like iron filings align themselves in the direction of the magnetic poles when there is a magnet, automatically. Similarly, we should also align our consciousness and our desires with Krishna's desires. So Krishna is a transcendental magnet, and we are the iron filings, little small iron filings. So we got to align ourselves north-south in the same direction. But there's one condition in which the magnet is not able to attract the filings. What is that condition? Rust. When the iron filings get rusted, then they don't get attracted to the magnet because the rust prevents the attraction from happening. It interferes with the magnetic attraction. So similarly, Krishna's attraction is overwhelming. He's all attractive. And in fact, he's so attractive that it's a miracle that we can't get attracted to him. That if there's somebody who doesn't get attracted to Krishna, that is a miracle. Nowadays, in this material world, we think it's a miracle if someone is attracted to Krishna. But actually, it's a miracle that people are not attracted to Krishna, because he's the all-attractive personality of Godhead. And the only explanation for people not getting attracted to Krishna is because of Krishna. Because of Krishna's illusory potency. That is, that covers the living entity like the rust covers the iron filing. And therefore it prohibits or inhibits the living entity from getting attracted to Krishna. But when that iron filing, you know, you rub it and you scrape off the rust, then gradually, to the degree you've scraped off that rust, the iron filing starts getting attracted once again to the magnet. The magnet is as powerful as before, but now we start removing the covering of rust. And then the attraction once again manifests. Similarly, by chanting the holy names of the Lord, Cheto Darpana Marjanam, as we've been discussing in the last two evenings, then the rust of material consciousness that's covering the soul also gets cleansed, gets scraped away, washed away. And then our natural attraction to Krishna, our inclination to Krishna, is aroused. This is called Krishna Mati. Mati means consciousness or intelligence. Then we become Krishna conscious. That's the highest benediction or blessing we can ever have. Whenever Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would bless someone, he would say, Krishna Mati Rahu. May your mati, your intelligence or consciousness be always in Krishna. That's the ultimate blessing we can ask for, that we can become Krishna conscious. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Yes. Yes.
But when we see deities before installation, let's say maybe it's just a matter that once Acharya is invited, then God is manifested. So what's the difference? Potentially, I mean, is it fair to say that atoms have potency that can be manifested? Krishna can manifest the atom? Or is he actually present?
The question is that if Krishna is present in every atom, but then we see that when the deities are installed, it is said that after the installation, then the Lord manifests himself as the deity. So how are we to understand that? Does it mean that Krishna wasn't present in the atoms before that constitute the deity? Well, that's a separate phenomenon. You see, Krishna is present not just in the atoms that constitute the stone of which the deity is constructed, but Krishna is present in every atom everywhere, all over the creation. But when we say that the deity is non-different from Krishna, it means that the particular form in which that stone has been crafted, it becomes non-different from the deity, from Krishna. Krishna manifests his presence in these material elements, whether it's stone or wood or clay or jewels, etc. So he actually becomes, he manifests himself directly as the entire deity. So this is a separate concept than the fact that he is within every atom. That he remains anyway. In every atom, not just in the stone of which the deity is sculpted. Yes? He kindly agrees to manifest himself in these material elements. Because their material elements are also his energy. So he can manifest himself as he likes, and he can unmanifest also if he doesn't want to be there. So therefore, when people attack a deity, we talked about it maybe in the first lecture I gave you when I came. So even if they succeed in physically harming a deity, Krishna may unmanifest himself when he likes from that deity. He may manifest himself and he may also unmanifest himself as he chooses. Right? Any other question? Yes. Eventually, will all jivas go back to the spiritual world? We don't know. Haridas Thakur says not likely. Because the jivas have been here for a long time, and there's practically an infinite number of jivas here in the material creation. In fact, Mahaprabhu asks Haridas Thakur, Haridas Thakur, you're saying that when we chant loudly the holy names of the Lord, then all the jivas here will be delivered and sent back to the spiritual world. But if we were to send back all the jivas to the spiritual world, then the universe would become empty. So what would happen? So Haridas Thakur says, no, because there are many jivas who are whose consciousness is not developed. And they are in living entity, they are in forms like stones and so on, and they will also manifest. And again, the universe will be filled up as before. So in a sense, because we're talking of such an enormously large number of jivas, which is practically infinite, so realistically it's not going to happen. We can hope and pray it does, but it's not, because the material creation will go on. It has been going on from time immemorial, and this will continue. So there will always be jivas here who are rebellious to Krishna. But this material world remains a very small part of the total creation of the Lord. The majority of the creation is actually spiritual. Okay, yes.
So, returning to that example, was it fair that our sun is a motorcycle? The question is, if there's a free will, and...
if there is?
Yeah, there is a free will.
Free will, yeah. Your question is, why didn't Krishna create a world where we wouldn't have to pay the price for our actions? There is such a world, and that's called the spiritual world. But it's only certain kinds of actions that can permit one to stay there. There are certain kinds of actions that are not permitted there. So when the jiva wants to be rebellious or independent of Krishna, then that would create a disturbance in the whole atmosphere in the spiritual world. So a separate world has to be created. So your question is that when Krishna says, look, if you go there, you do this, you will get this. So that's interference in the free will. No. Krishna is not forcing that living entity to do a particular kind of action. But he says, if you do this, this is the result. If you do that, that is the result. If you do yet another thing, that will be the result. Now you choose.
Yes,
so the free will is not interfered with.
Yeah, well, it's the same as I have a son, and he has some desires, right? And I can create a situation. And I don't want him to pursue his desires. But I create a situation where, I understand if he does it, he'll get the results. He will have to pay the price.
Yes, but you see, the father is not creating a situation where the child will get an accident. The father is leaving it to him. You want this motorcycle, but look, it's risky. If something happens, it will be very difficult for you to tolerate. So the father is not creating the accident or a situation or not facilitating the accident, but the son, by his rash behavior, may do that. So he may go on a motorcycle, one day end up in a severe accident, and then say, okay, my father was right, better I don't do that. So similarly, Krishna is not facilitating suffering for us deliberately, but he's saying, look, this world is programmed or designed in such a way that, you will get it because it's a jail.
Yeah, but that's Krishna who designed this world, isn't it?
Yes, of course, Krishna is designed. Yes.
So isn't it like should we understand it in a way that Krishna actually designed it in this way because he didn't want us to actually go away?
Yes,
in
yes.
The way he actually influences our free will.
No. No. It's like this. Let me give you another example. There's the state and there's the jail. Every country has jails. Now, why are jails required? Because there's always going to be a certain section of the population that doesn't obey the laws of the state. Now, for those citizens who are law-abiding, everything is wonderful. You have so much freedom. Yes, we voluntarily accept limits to our freedom because that's essential to live in a civilized society. We voluntarily accept certain boundaries and you say, well, I can't do beyond this. But because we voluntarily accept those boundaries, therefore, for all practical purposes, we are free to do so many things. For example, living here in Australia, you can go anywhere in Australia you like. You can take up any profession that is legally permitted by the state. You can sleep, you can eat, you can go here, you can do anything you like. You can come to this temple. But if you decide that I don't want to follow the laws of the state, and you perform some actions in violation, then the police arrest you. And they say, because you misused your freedom, so now we're going to put you in a situation where you will have even more restriction on your freedom. And that's the jail. So it's not that the police or the government wants you to commit a crime and that it wants you to go there into the jail. But they're saying, if you do, then this is the destination. So similarly, this material world is like a jail. The spiritual world is like the kingdom where there are law-abiding citizens. When people who violate the laws of the state live in the kingdom of God and they are rebellious, then it spoils, it disturbs the spiritual world. So then they're sent here to this jail. And the jail has different norms and different rules compared to the rules in the spiritual world. So here in the material world, it's like a jail. Everybody is confined in so many ways. They're confined to little jail cells. So we're confined to these bodies. We're confined by the laws of nature. So Krishna says, look, if you go there, then this is what is in store for you. If you stay here and surrender to me and become my devotee, everything will be wonderful. But because they want to misuse their independence and free will, so they are sent here. So if you go here, you got to follow, you will be subjected to these rules. If you stay here, the condition is this, that you have to surrender to me and become my pure and serve me. So Krishna doesn't interfere in the free will. He gives us a choice. Here or there. But if it's here, then these are the laws. If it's there, then those are the laws. Take a choice. Right? Even after speaking the Bhagavad Gita to Krishna, to Arjuna, Krishna says, yathechhasi tatha kuru. Okay, Arjuna, I have told you the whole message of the Bhagavad Gita. Now it's up to you. You do as you choose. As you think fit. So even Krishna doesn't force Arjuna. But he tells him, if you cultivate the demoniac qualities and commit sinful activities, these are the destinations you'll have to go to. If you cultivate the divine qualities, then this is the destination you'll reach. The choice is yours. Right? So he's not interfering with the free will. Is it clear? He makes the rules. He makes the rules of the game. Not Krishna doesn't follow the rules of the game. He's the one who makes the rules of the game. He's the Supreme Lord.
But in that way, he's basically, you know, affecting the free choice.
No, he's not affecting the free choice. He's just
by making the rules. Because then you have to follow this rule, you know. Because otherwise, he would make
Is the state government interfering with your free will? Is the government of Australia interfering with your free will? Yes, the same way Krishna is not interfering with the free will of the jivas. But is the state interfering with the free will of prisoners in the jails in Australia? Why? It's restricting the scope for the free will because of something that's been done earlier. So those jivas who misuse their free will outside the prison are sent into the prison, and now they are basically confined. They have some degree of free will, but not as much as they have outside. They are physically confined, they are forced to do certain kinds of work and so on. They still have the free will, but because they misused it earlier, so there are severe limitations imposed on the exercise of that free will. Okay? No, very simple. Very simple. Okay, one last question. Yes. Okay, so this question is regarding a devotee who begins to surrender to Krishna, and Krishna may take away certain things from that devotee's life in order to facilitate his surrender. Now, here we are talking of another category. When we talk of the normal rules of the material world, we are talking of those prisoners who are the ordinary prisoners. They are subject to the ordinary rules. However, when a certain prisoner develops a good rapport with the king, the king says, all right, now I'll give special pardon, because the king or the president has the powers to pardon a criminal. He says, okay, then since this devotee, this person is now surrendering to me, he's accepting me and he's become close to me, so therefore I may manipulate the rules a little bit, I may give some special favors to him, or I'll see what I can do with him. He takes a special interest in that prisoner. So similarly, when the living entity stops being an ordinary prisoner, that means a non-devotee, and starts taking interest in Krishna consciousness and wants to surrender seriously, then Krishna now starts taking personal interest. Earlier, he had outsourced that to his agents. So the material energy, the demigods and so on and so forth, they were looking after the dispensation of justice and action, reaction and all that. But now Krishna says, okay, hold on, all you people, just take a step back. Now I'm going to intervene here because this jiva is surrendering to me. He wants to utilize his free will to serve me, so I want to facilitate that. I'm going to take things in my own hands now. So to the degree of that jiva surrender to Krishna, Krishna will personally intervene in that devotee's life. So this is an intermediate state. And then when we go to the spiritual world, it's the other extreme. The conditioned sinful living entity in the material world is one extreme. The spiritual world is the other extreme. And we struggling devotees, we're trying to surrender to Krishna, become his pure devotees. We are moving from one extreme to the other. We are in the process of moving, so Krishna is facilitating our movement. Because that's essentially Krishna's goal. Everything he does, the whole design of the material world is, the intention is that he wants to facilitate our movement towards the spiritual world. It's only that we don't pay heed to it. But even the suffering that the jivas experience in this world is intended for that purpose, to push us towards the spiritual world. All right, okay, final one. Yes, Mahatma Prabhu. He's a doctor, so I better...
You read that point. That
sorry?
What I'm going to ask.
Yes.
You read that point. I just wanted to know, tell us how you do it on.
Uh-oh. I think it's time for prasadam now. We should have more important subjects to deal with. Okay, Hare Krishna.
How one can attain such a knowledge?
No, we should. Okay, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Gaur Premanande, Hare Krishna.